Hello and welcome back to PaleoCast. My name is Dave Marshall and this is episode 120 on the remarkable discovery of an ammonite without its shell. So, what happened to separate the ammonite from its conch? And now that it's gone, what can we actually see of the soft body anatomy? Joining us to answer these questions and more is Professor Christian Klug from the University of Zurich in Switzerland. But before we get into the episode, just want to wish you all a happy 2021, and here's hoping that this year will be much better than the last. Thanks so much for all the messages we've had through recently. It's been great talking, and I'm so glad that this podcast has been something to look forward to for so many of you. It really does mean a lot to get that feedback. It's also why I'm feeling a bit guilty about only putting an episode out now we're in February, but sometimes this just happens. It's the start of a new term and interviewees all had hectic schedules, with the festive period and also a global pandemic to deal with. But we're back on track now, so expect more great interviews in the weeks and months ahead. As always, we have pictures on our website that accompany this episode, and this really is an interview where you need to be looking at the pictures. Whether that's to trace cephalopod evolution on a tree or just to have a look at this bizarre specimen. And as I'm sure you're all aware by now, likes, shares, comments, reviews, and donations are all appreciated and helps this scientific content reach new audiences. Thanks for helping out, and I hope you enjoyed this episode. Hi, Christian. Thanks so much for coming on the show today.
Thanks for inviting me.
So we always like to get to know our interviewee first. So I'll just ask my standard opening question of how you got into the field of paleontology.
Well, actually, I guess like so many people, I was intrigued by all kinds of natural things when I was a boy. And one day my uncle actually went up to me and he said, "Oh, Christian, do you want to collect golden snails, in German Goldschnecken?" And I was, of course, totally enthusiastic and didn't know what this was. And it turned out that they were actually early Jurassic ammonites, which were piratized. So we went there, and back then he had actually a really fancy sort of race car-like thing. And we went to this clay pit in southern Germany, and we found really small but really cute little prioritized ammonites. And I guess this is more or less when it all started. And some years later, I actually found the same place, the oldest Brachyuran crab, which was then named after me. And I think at the latest by then it was decided what would happen to me at later years, so to say.
Wow, that's awesome. I would like to ask about the ammonites and the crab, but I'm more interested in this car. Do you know what it was?
Oh, I don't recall, actually. You know, it's so long ago. I'm so old in the meantime. It's like, it must have been early 80s, I think, like 82, 81, something like that. And it was not a Porsche. It was not a German car. I think it was something
Sarah
maybe
Ferrari, then.
Japanese. No, it looked really fast.
Yeah, nice. My early fossil hunting wasn't done in a sports car, so I'm a bit jealous. But never mind. What would you be doing then if you weren't a paleontologist?
You mean as an alternative for what?
Yeah. We'll run your life again. You said golden snails, not interested.
Uh-huh, okay.
What became of you?
So my plan B always was becoming a teacher, but I'm kind of happy that I'm what I am today, because I actually do teach and I do enjoy that as well. And I do research, and I think this is one of the greatest things you can do.
So you're a professor now at the University of Zurich. Where do your research interests lie? What's the normal day like for you?
It's actually quite chaotic. It ranges from hunting rhinoceroses in kindergartens in the forest while examining soft tissue preservation in placoderms from Morocco to squids from Lebanon and ammonites from everywhere, basically. So it's kind of, I'm jumping back and forth. I'm a bit hedonistic in my research. Whatever attracts my attention, this is actually way too much, actually gets my attention.
So there's no kind of like unifying theme. Are you concentrated on a certain area or a certain group of fossils?
Well, I do come back to cephalopods all the time, and well, also taphonomy, exceptional preservation, soft tissue preservation, but also the Devonian. And I always had a certain love for big fishes like sharks and also placoderms. So I also keep coming back to these groups.
And I've got an interest in the Devonian as well, and I can't really explain it. I just kind of look at it and I'm like, yes, Devonian's for me. What is it about that time for you? And what is it about those groups, about these big fishes and about the cephalopods that you find fascinating?
So I think the Devonian is far away enough from us time-wise that it has a lot of really strange creatures which we do not understand in full. So there is a lot of, let's say, detective work that needs to be done, a lot of questions we might never be able to find good answers to, and there's just enough awkwardness and strangeness and distance to make it really interesting and intriguing, I find.
Okay, so one of the groups that you work on are the cephalopods, and this episode is going to be on an ammonite or ammonoid. What's the difference between all of those terms? So can you give us an introduction to the world of cephalopods?
Okay, so the ending ammonoid, ammonite, this basically refers to the group. So ammonoids actually encompass all the ammonites, while the ammonites comprise only those which actually are from mainly Jurassic and Cretaceous times. So it's a kind of a taxonomic term, if you want.
Is ammonite a subset of ammonoids?
Exactly.
Okay. And what are some of the other different cephalopod groups? So how do ammonoids differ from, say, belemnites or some of the other squiddy things?
Okay, so maybe I give a short overview over cephalopod evolution, which started in the Cambrian. So there's a bunch of localities in the Cambrian, and actually one of my PhD students, Alex, is working on this and is going to publish some exciting new results there. So we have these very small conical shells at the beginning, which were found pretty much worldwide, and which have very narrow chambers and which are actually quite small and have a ventral siphuncle. And these gave rise to a bunch of really interesting groups in the Ordovician already, and some of which probably reached size of up to 10 meters. And one of those groups that originated in the Ordovician is the Orthocerids. And they are important because they later gave rise to the Bactritoids. And Bactritoids are kind of a inconspicuous little group which is not known by too many, which has rather slender shells, also conical, with a ventral siphuncle. Some are coiled, some are straight. And these gave rise again to what are the coleoids, so including squids, belemnites, and so forth on the one side. And on the other side, there's the ammonoids, which simply continued coiling their shells and then became what we know as ammonoids. But actually, the Bactritids, they are paraphyletic. So there is an ongoing discussion whether we should include the Bactritoids maybe in the coleoids, and then the ammonoids would be coleoids too. So, but now this is maybe a bit too complicated here, too special, I don't know.
And, oh, yes. And the it's one of those things that you need to see the tree out in front of you. So We'll try and get that tree, and then it's so much easier to follow than just with audio.
True.
But yes. So let's just focus on the Ammonites then. When you see an Ammonite fossil, typically, what is it you're actually looking at?
Usually we find the outer shell, which is usually coiled. And the cool thing about Ammonites is actually they kind of carry their entire life history inside their shell. So you have usually, well, if it's well preserved at least, you have the embryonic shell in the middle, which starts with a more or less spherical structure, and then the following whorls wrap around it. And if the shell is not preserved, you can see the suture lines, which are sometimes really beautiful, and which are probably one of the reasons why many fossil collectors and paleontologists alike do like them.
So the suture lines are the wiggly, like, internal walls of each of the shells? Is that right?
Well, more or less, yeah. It's like this. They have a chambered phragmocone, which was filled with gas, at least partially, and partially with water. And these walls, they're actually folded, but they're only slightly folded in their center and towards the outside, so towards the line where they touched the outer shell wall, so to say, they became more and more folded. And this is what we call the suture line, where they touch the shell wall.
Okay. And there's something in the evolution of that, isn't there?
Yes, there is. And it becomes more and more complicated. And the first suture lines are actually just gently wavy and look like not much. And this changed quite quickly, and they became much more complicated until it got really insane in the Mesozoic.
And what advantage did that give? Did it give any, or is it just one of those things that happens?
Well, actually, I could talk probably for about an hour about that topic.
Oh, God, yeah.
So there's new papers coming up every year. And I think much of it is actually fabricational noise, as Seiler has put it. So it has to do with growth of the conch and with the formation of new septa. And what happens is that actually the posterior mantle, the septal mantle, which forms the new septa, it kind of retains the shape of the previous septum. But then when it moves forward inside the shell tube, it has to fill a larger area, so to say. So it grows outward. And while growing outward, it starts folding. So the more often it kind of gets copied, and the more often it has to grow outward, the more folds you get. So this is basically the process that's happening there.
That's really interesting. I've not actually heard any of that. So yeah, that's a whole other episode to be done. But so we have this variation in the suture lines, the back wall of the body chamber, effectively, and how it joins to the inside margin of the outer conch. So we got that variation inside, but on the outside, we've just got a coiled shell. I mean, how much variation can there be in that outer coiled shell so that we can tell all of these different species apart?
So there can be quite some variation within species, and of course also between different species. And as you and as many of those people listening probably know, there's actually enormous variation ranging from forms with straight shells like Baculites to those which have really awkward knot-like shapes like Nipponites, or then the regularly coiled ones like, I don't know, Amelthias, Stephanoceras, and whatever. So there's many species which are just regularly coiled. And what I really love about them is how they actually change their coiling mode when they grow adult. And that is actually how we can also tell whether they're males and females with some certainty.
I did not know this. What's the difference between the two?
So, well, this has been actually proposed already in the 60s, and remarkably, it was discovered simultaneously by a Polish and a British colleague. And what they realized is that within one layer, they sometimes kept finding two different forms, which shared the internal whorls. The morphology of the internal whorls were identical, but towards the outside it changed. So there was one form which was much larger with a rather smooth shell and a rather simple aperture, while the other form stayed much smaller, had a much stronger ornament, and often a really strangely formed aperture with sometimes really awkward lappets on both sides. And these are probably what we think is the males. And this is supported actually by our new finding.
Well, we'll get onto that soon. I would like to know, do we know what the conch is made from? Is it always the same material?
Yeah, it's actually sort of interesting because sometimes you think, this is well known. But then if you look more closely, you find out, it's actually not that well known. and this applies here as well. For example, we do know that most of it is aragonite. So these little tiny platelets, which are hexagonal, which are arranged in stacks. And in between, we have actually organic matter. And this causes that it has this nacreous luster if they're really well preserved. But I know from a Czech colleague, Jiří Frida, he looked more closely at the structure of ammonite shells, and he figured out that actually there's a very thin layer of calcite hidden within, which has never been described. So I'm waiting actually for him to publish this one day.
I've got a feeling, as you said, that every question that I'm asking is going to have an answer that's like, well, actually, it's incredibly complicated. I've never had that for something. So some of these questions, I wrote them down thinking, oh, this will be a nice, simple question, like, what's the shell made out of? But yeah, I mean, it's just a great subject. Ammonites, there's so much, like, I personally have already found out, and we're not even through the introduction yet. So you mentioned the nacre, which is the kind of like crazy colored pearly kind of material, is that right?
Yeah.
Do we actually find pearls in ammonites as we
do
some other mollusks?
Yes, we do. And we described that actually, well, this has been described early on from the Cretaceous. And we described this, so Kennedy Bartz and me, some years ago from Devonian ammonites. But in this case, they were fixed pearls, so they were attached to the inside of the conch. So sometimes they are loose. That's what we use for earrings and so forth. And sometimes they really are kind of glued to the shell wall, so to say. And usually they surround foreign objects like sand grains or sometimes parasites. And back then, when we described that, we suggested that was parasites that were kind of encased by that aragonite, by these pearls.
How much would a ammonitic pearl be worth?
Well, I guess it's like with crystals, like diamonds and I don't know what. I would say it depends on the luster and the shape and whatever. But I think usually they don't look like much because the aragonite is often not so nice. So you don't have this mother of pearl-like luster. And so I guess it wouldn't reach like really big prizes, I guess.
So we're going to get on to the subject of a recent paper that you published on a very special ammonite. So let's first set the stage of when and where it was found.
Okay, so it was found near Eichstätt, and Eichstätt is a beautiful little town in northern Bavaria in Germany. And Eichstätt is actually not far away from Solnhofen. And if you look at this area in Google Earth or Google Maps under the satellite photos, then you see that it's actually, it looks like someone suffering from a terrible acne because it's full of little quarries. And this region has become famous for its platy limestones. And these were used in early times of bookmaking for printing, so for lithography. That's why it's also called lithographic limestone. And because there are so many quarries, people started finding really amazing fossils like the iconic Archaeopteryx and plenty of soft-tissued animals, fishes, reptiles, and what beautiful pterosaurs, actually. And also, interestingly, preserved cephalopods, including ammonites and quite broad, wide variety of coleoids, like squid-like animals.
Okay, and what kind of paleo environment do these lithographic limestones represent?
So, classically, this is seen as sort of an archipelago of small islands and lagoons in between, in a more or less tropical sea, and the sheltered situation of these lagoons between islands or reefal complexes explains why there wasn't too much water movement and why there was maybe also not too much oxygen near the sediment surface. And this explains why we get an exceptional preservation, because there was not too much scavenging and the decay processes were rather slow, and the mechanical disturbations like would also be minimal, because there were no avalanches, no ground touching waves, and I don't know what.
Okay, and there's been a couple of specimens found of these ammonites that we're going to talk about, and they were found at different sites. So you've got, pardon my German, one at Nusslingen and another at Wintershof.
Yeah.
Is there any difference between the two sites, or is it just a continuation of the same kind of limestone between the two?
So Nusslingen actually is a little bit older. It's a really small quarry, which is in Baden-Württemberg, which is actually quite far away from the Eichstätt-Solnhofen region. But we have the same kind of preservation. It's a bit older, and we have quite similar fossils there. Wintershof is just next to Eichstätt, so it really belongs to this area. And, well, it's interesting because of the similar preservation, and we use the specimen for Nusslingen mainly for comparison. And in Nusslingen, it's like this, like in Pinten, that we have a different organic preservation. So stuff like the jaws, which have been chitinous, they appear in a brownish to blackish substance. So they're actually much better visible than is the case in the Solnhofen-Eichstätt region, where often we do see the structures, but they don't have this neat brownish color.
Okay, so now that we've set that stage, let's focus on these remarkable specimens that have been found themselves. So what is so special about them?
So the special thing about this one specimen is that it is actually the soft parts, basically, of an ammonite with its jaws that must have fallen out somehow of the shell. And this is something which I have never come across before, and which is intriguing by itself. But I must say, at the beginning when I saw it, I was like, oh, cool, interesting, but I have no idea what I'm seeing exactly.
We don't normally get soft parts preserved at all, do we? But this time it's completely the opposite way around. We normally find the hard parts without the soft, but in this instance, we've got the soft parts without the hard.
Well, that's not Entirely correct, because we do have the jaws and they are hard. And that is actually how we know that these are ammonites, because the lower jaw of many of these Jurassic and Cretaceous ammonites are often made of calcite. And this makes the likelihood of being preserved very high. And they're very typical. And this is why we were actually able to determine the genus of this ammonite. So we know which kind of conch would belong to that soft part, so to say. So this was quite important. And this is how we knew at all that this was an ammonite.
Okay, that's amazing. But in general, what did we know about the soft parts of ammonites prior to the discovery of these ones from Nusslingen and Winterhoff?
Well, there's very little we knew. There's a couple of cases of stomach contents that are preserved, for example, also from the Solnhofen-Eichstätt region, from Lebanon, and also from Russia a little bit. And from Russia, we also know ovaries preserved with embryos of ammonites. And a couple of years ago, I described soft parts from the Cretaceous of Germany, where we do see quite a lot, like the entire digestive tract. And I suggest that we do see the brain and maybe the base of the arm crown. But that was not very certain. And there's another specimen that has been actually... It has been published, but not in great detail, from the Middle Jurassic of the UK.
Wow, I didn't really realize it was that much we knew about the soft body.
Yeah, well, actually, it's not that much, because if you take into account how many millions of ammonites have been collected by private people and by paleontologists, that is actually just a few places and specimens which do show soft parts. And there's a lot of things we don't know. Like, for example, we still don't know what the arms looked like.
Okay, but with this specimen, what can we actually see in this? Do we have the arms in this one?
That is actually also intriguing, because the arms are not there. But the question is, are they not preserved, or do we just not see them because they maybe are lying underneath, or they have been in the other plate, which has not been found? So there's different options. Or they were ripped off in the course of the soft parts being removed from the conch. So I don't really know what happened there. But besides, we do see a lot. We see the entire digestive tract. And this was actually how I started. So it was obvious that there's the jaws. And the jaws, they must be at the anterior end of the body. And then I kind of tried to follow the logical sequence of body parts, which we know from cephalopods. And then there's one thing which is kind of interesting, because the esophagus is often covered by a thin sheet of chitin. And chitin is often preserved in phosphates. And the phosphates, in turn, they shine when we put a UV light onto it. And this is what I saw when I looked at the UV photos, which were taken by my co-author Helmut Tischlinger.
Okay, so you managed to trace all of this digestive tract all the way back. Were there any surprises in the anatomy that you could see? Were there things that you found that had never been seen before that you had to interpret based on, I don't know, what we know from nautiloids, for example?
So as I just started to explain, I followed the digestive tract, and then the next thing I could identify was actually a so-called cololite. So this is basically in the making, which is still in the intestine. This is how I identified the intestine, and this helped me identify in turn the stomach, which is quite a reasonably big structure. And in cephalopods, it's like this, that the intestine actually leads to the back of the mantle cavity. And this is also where the gills are located. And that is how I could identify those. And in the end, I had a strange structure, which was actually sort of underneath the stomach. And I wasn't so sure what that was, but I was kind of guessing that this might have to do with the reproductive organs, because they are usually way back in the body chamber. And this is what we have in Nautilus, and this is kind of also the situation we have in squids and octopuses. So, and then I looked again at the UV light photos, and I saw little comma-shaped structures in this bigger structure. And then I went to the literature and looked at what we see in Nautilus, and it looked quite similar to what we have actually in the male reproductive organs of living Nautilus.
So we've got an unfortunate male here that's lost its shell.
Yeah, that is what I think. There was actually some discussion online about this, because a colleague, or let's say collector from Spain, he said, I don't think this is a microcong, so there might be a problem here. And I don't know. But in any case, I'm actually pretty sure that this is the male reproductive organs, because I identified a series of structures which we see in the male reproductive organs in Nautilus, like the two spermatophore sacs and the penis, basically, and the spermatophoric gland. So these four structures are all visible in that fossil. So I think this is, to me, it was pretty convincing, at least.
Nice. You mentioned what I bleeped out before the digestive contents. Can you tell what it was eating?
Well, on this particular specimen, I can't, because this, let's say, a little bit of which is still in its intestine is just a very fine-grained mass of stuff. So I cannot tell. But there's other findings from the Solnhofen-Eichstätt area. And from that, we know that they fed on small animals, including other ammonites and swimming sea lilies, crinoids. And I think there's also ostracods, as far as I remember, but I would have to look that up. But there's a bunch of small animals they were eating, and that is more or less well-known.
Well known to ammonite researchers, this is all news to me. This is fantastic. I just didn't know you could get so much information from ammonites. This interview is blowing my mind. Right, we have this fantastic, all of this fantastic soft body information, but to me, and possibly to many of our listeners, we've got the pictures on our website and as the YouTube cover picture, everything like that. It's just a load of blobs of different colors. It's pretty hard to make out. I don't look at it and think, oh, you know what? That's an ammonite just missing its shell. So how hard was it to interpret for you? Were you able to just look at it and be like, yes, that's an ammonite? And then when it was collected, was it instantly recognized as an ammonite without its shell? Or did it just sit in a museum for decades with no one really knowing what it was?
So it was a collector who found it, and I think he knew immediately what it was, that because of the lower jaw, because this is very typical, and the people collecting fossils in the Solnhofen-Eichstätt area, they know these jaws. So he surely recognized that immediately, but he was surprised about the other parts. And I then got the photos via Günter Schweigert, who's also co-author. And then actually, I recognized this as soft parts, but I wasn't able to tell right away what is what. And what I usually do in such cases is I first make some drawings, and then I try to homologize part by part. And that is what I did. And actually, it started with the esophagus, because, as I said, this was shining under UV light. And the esophagus has a strange kink. And this kink I knew from other ammonites and also from Nautilus. So this helped me to identify this. And then a little later, I discovered this little cololite, so the unready, so to say. And this is how I step by step managed to identify the parts. And what I forgot to say, actually, between me starting to work on this fossil and getting the photos, about a year or two passed where I wasn't too sure how to handle it.
Are we talking the UV photos there?
Well, the UV photos I got only later, but they were important because they helped me to recognize both the esophagus and spermatophores, because I didn't see them at first in the white light photos, in the normal photos.
Mm. So I find it really interesting. We've done an interview on UV light, especially in terms of what you can see in dinosaurs, I think it was, that interview. And I'm really interested in it as a new method for seeing more in fossils. So without it, would it have been possible to have interpreted all of the anatomy of this ammonite, or did it play a really critical role?
It actually played an important role, because I think I would have had much more trouble identifying the esophagus. And you just see different things, and you see the things also differently. So it helps you getting ideas and helps you homologizing. And sometimes it shows details much clearer and crisper, so you can really figure out what you're actually looking at. So I think it's like when you have an illness and you ask two doctors, that's sometimes better than asking one, you know, like you get kind of two different opinions, and this helps you figuring out what you're actually looking at. And this might be this is probably especially true for soft tissues, no matter if they're from a funny dinosaur butt or from a nemonite.
So reference to the dinosaur butt there, that was the new paper by Jakob, who's also been on this show. And that was UV light on a Tetacosaurus that revealed details of its cloaca. So that's some big news. If you haven't already seen that one, go check that out, Dinosaur Bum. But back on ammonites, you mentioned before that the crown of arms, so in, I guess, layman's terms, the tentacles. I know they're not tentacles, that's a very specific thing, but the wiggly arms at the front, we don't know about those. But is there anything else that's still left unknown about their anatomy? Any specific organs that have never been seen before?
That's a good question. There's a lot of things we do have, because, for example, interestingly, the brain is encased in a chitinous shell, so to say, which is also preserved occasionally, and also in this specimen, I think there's some remains of it seen. The eyes are not very well preserved, but I think there is remains of the eyes, or at least of the optic part of the brain preserved. But the thing that would really interest me the most is the arm crown, as you said, because we can make kind of, let's say, estimated guesses that they had 10 arms. And based on this, well, the absence of preservation, we can conclude that they were not really strong and thick and so on. They must have been probably rather fine and short, because otherwise we would have seen in the sediments of the Solnhofen-Eichstätt region, we would have seen imprints sometimes, because we've seen imprints of the arms of all sorts of squids and octopuses preserved there.
Do they have hooks on their arms?
That's also a good question, but no, I was about to say no, but this is not entirely certain at this point. So most ammonites did not have arm hooks. Arm hooks are a feature we usually know from belemnites and their relatives, but there is a structure that has been described recently from Cretaceous ammonites by Isabel Kruta and some colleagues, and this might be arm hooks of some specialized reproductive arm or so, which had hook-like structures on the surface. At least this is the best interpretation for the time being, but this is just this one genus where this has been described so far. Otherwise, there's no hooks.
Okay. So now we have this fantastic record of an internal anatomy of an ammonite, but we now have to solve this mystery as to why we have this ammonite without its conch in the first place. So what have been some of the hypotheses as to where the shell went? Where is it? And what are the likelihoods, relatively, of each hypothesis being true?
Well, so one would be simply it has been dissolved. Because aragonite is never preserved, well, not never, but almost very rarely in this region. But this is unlikely because we would at least normally see an imprint of the shell, so like a kind of a cast or so. And that's not there, so that is unlikely. The second hypothesis would be that the animal somehow died, and then the muscular attachment of the soft parts to the shell started rotting and became loose, and maybe due to wave action or so, it just kind of fell out of the shell and sank down. And the third hypothesis is that it was a predator that pulled out the soft parts. So, and this is actually what we think is the most plausible explanation.
Okay. Is there any way to test these hypotheses? Can you get a bunch of modern nautilus, kill them all, and then see if you can shake them loose or pull them out or something like this? Is there any way to say for certain?
Okay, so first of all, the connection of the soft body to the shell is quite weak. And this has to do with the fact that during growth, the ammonite has to kind of loosen this attachment again and again to move forward within the body chamber to give space for new chambers that are forming at the rear end. So the connection is not very strong. And we know that at least in modern nautiluses, the connection is also quite, loose, so to say, and when they're dead, it's quite easy to take the soft parts out. So for the other hypothesis about predation, there is a hypothesis by Klompmarker, who was published about 10 years ago, where he realized that many ammonites from the Mesozoic, particularly, they have kind of a hole in the back of the body chamber, which was not there primarily. So he suggested that this is a trace of predation where some animal cracked open the rear of the body chamber. And this is interesting because this is where the main muscles inserted. And if you would loosen that connection, you would get out the soft parts quite easily. Because otherwise, what happens if you try to get the soft parts from the front? The animal would just withdraw its soft parts far back into the body chamber, and there would be no way of reaching it. And this is something that also has been demonstrated actually by Björn Kröger from Helsinki, who showed that there's healed cracks in the body chambers of ammonites, which went back for like a quarter world or so, which were healed. So there was enough of the soft parts that survived and were able to repair that massive damage that was inflicted by some predator.
That would take a lot of intelligence to specifically attack those muscles, wouldn't it?
Yes, I totally agree. And I mean, in the sea, we have a bunch of intelligent creatures, and these are, of course, vertebrates. But among the invertebrates, these are the cephalopods. And actually, this is something I was discussing with my co-authors quite lengthily, so to say, because first I thought this could have been pycnodontid fish, which have really massive crushing dentitions, and they are also known from this area, so this could have been possible. But then they argued, yes, they do occur, but they are extremely rare. By contrast, coleoids, so octopus relatives, they're actually quite common. And as you know, they're really clever animals. And it is quite well possible that with their quite pointed beaks, they were able to crack open the rather thin shells of ammonites.
It's remarkable that you could have this possible record of a failed predation. Why might it have failed, though?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, what's also possible, there was, again, a larger predator disturbing the smaller predator trying to eat the ammonite. So it was disturbed by something, or maybe there was a big wave, or I don't know what. And for example, what we have described last year is that occasionally even pterosaurs were fishing for squid from the sea. We have direct evidence for that. So maybe there was a pterosaur touching the sea surface. The squid was shocked, swam away, and dropped the ammonite. This would have been a possibility. But it is, of course, highly speculative, I must admit.
I find it interesting as well that we have this specimen preserved without its shell, whereas the other ammonites that might have died in their shells and sank to the bottom don't have the soft parts as well. Do you think that in this location, or I suppose in any other location, we'll find a 100% complete ammonite soft body, pretty much the same as you've got here, but also the shell with it?
Well, I think if we really have the shell preserved, then we probably wouldn't see it simply. So what we need is really this kind of Fossillagerstätte, as we have in the Solnhofen-Eichstätt area, in Nusplingen, but also in, let's say, Christian-Malfort, or in Lebanon, or we described recently fossils from the late Cretaceous of Greece. So if you have these lithographic limestones with these very flat limestone bits and with an organic preservation of soft tissues, I think this is where the chance is the greatest that we do find something that is even more complete, where we have, let's say, an imprint of the conch plus the soft parts preserved in one way or the other.
Is there still a lot we don't know about ammonites?
Well, I mean, if you look at the fossils, you see, okay, I kind of could make out what's what, but you don't see a great lot of details. And now this is just one species out of thousands, and it is also lacking a lot of detail. Like, for example, I would like to see more detail of the brain. I would like to see the precise position of the eyes. It sounds like a simple thing because, I mean, if you look at vertebrates, it's always immediately clear. Where are the eyes? But in the case of ammonites, no, it's not clear. Are they above the jaws? Are they next to the jaws? Are they in front of the jaws? What do they do when they close the jaws, let's say, to protect the soft parts? Did they pull the eyes behind the jaws, or were they still peeking out? There's so many open questions. It's really insane. I think every new soft tissue ammonoid has the potential of revealing interesting new information.
And what would you say to a student or someone that is considering studying ammonites?
You mean like what to do?
No, how to enthuse them with your love for ammonites.
Yeah, I think what's cool about ammonites is, first of all, there's a lot of things that are still unknown, although there's probably thousands of papers that have been written about them. And the cool thing about them is that they actually carry their own life history in their conchs. And you can study evo-devo with them. You can study variation. You can even study ecological things. You can study the isotopes in their shells to reconstruct paleotemperatures. You can, we have now a paper in work with a student of mine, with Celine, about one proxy where we can actually show that ocean acidification had an effect on their conchs. So there's so many things where you can use them and draw conclusions on paleoecology, paleoenvironment that is really far from being explored in full.
That's awesome. And we'll look forward to all of those discoveries once you make them back on the show. So thanks so much for coming on today.
Thank you very much for having me. And I hope the people listening to it, you enjoyed it a little bit.
PaleoCast was brought to you by Dave Marshall and Liz Martin-Silverstone, with contributions from Tom Fletcher, Vish Venkat, and Elsa Pancharoli. Music was composed by Patrick Kendall-Smith. PaleoCast was made possible by funding from the Paleontological Society and the Paleontological Association, but the show now relies on funding from you, the listeners. So, if you've liked this episode, please consider donating, and thanks to everyone that's helped out so far. Please visit paleocast.com for the supplementary material to this episode and for our archive of past programs, and follow us across social media platforms to get all the latest news. Finally, if you enjoy our podcast, then please explore all of our video content on YouTube and follow our other projects, the Virtual Natural History Museum and the PaleoCast Gaming Network.